proceed to the fifth case of the day, Patridge versus the United States Internal Revenue Service. That's appeal number 05-3249. Mr. Berenger.
Thank you, Your Honors. My name is Jerry Berenger. Ms. Fullman, my name is Jerry Berenger on behalf of Denny and Judy Patridge. In the process of the briefing and thereafter, Ms. Bowman, in fact, has sent to the court a couple of different documents along the way dealing with 6330 and how that applies for purposes of collection due process, including sending along, I believe, at some point, the tax court decision also dealing with Denny and Judy Patridge. There are right now, as a result of the various activities going on, three different appeals coming to this court: the criminal prosecution, the tax court decision, and the case we have here. And there's a fourth case that involves the activities between the Patridges and J.K. Harris. This case began as a result of notices of deficiencies back in 2000 and whether or not those were valid. The Patridges did not believe them to be valid. They hired J.K. Harris. They hired other people. But there was no challenge to the notices of deficiency. That's clear. Nobody's disputing that. The question is, what does that mean within 6330 as we get to the point of the process? Notices of assessment were alleged to have been sent in August of 2000. Demands were made by levy. Appeals were filed, and the process was stayed for a while because of the criminal prosecution. And then we began the process in the last summer of dealing with this collection due process and what applies and where it goes to. Challenges were made as to the validity, again, of the notices of deficiency. Challenges were made as to whether or not they were proper statutory notices. Challenges were made whether or not there were proper assessments. Challenges were made as to whether or not all applicable rules and regulations had been met. A variety of issues were raised. The IRS disputed that and denied the challenges. The case was filed in the Federal District Court, which is what brought us ultimately to here. Judge Scott ruled that there was no subject matter jurisdiction. The case was dismissed. We believe that under 6330, this is the exact kind of case that belongs here and belonged in the district court, not in the tax court. And I think it's clear from the tax court decision why that is, because the tax court decision approached it from the standpoint that no notice of deficiency was challenged. End of story. We don't care what other issues you have. You don't get to raise them. And that's exactly what 6330 was designed to do, was give the taxpayer an additional collection due process right, an additional collection due process procedure, and perhaps substantive right that dealt with whether or not the process that the IRS had followed was right. I don't know anyone who has said the notices of deficiency followed any particular law or were, in fact, even in compliance with law themselves. From the testimony that occurred, in fact, in the criminal case, everybody said, we don't know what law this follows. We don't believe the notices of deficiency were valid at all, that they were, in fact, illegal notices of deficiency. And so the question becomes, if you don't challenge those at the time that the notices of deficiency state, the 90 days or in this case a little bit more, if you don't challenge them at that point, do you lose all of your rights forever, even if it's not a valid process that the IRS followed? Can the IRS, in fact, violate the law and deny you the right at some point to say that's wrong? Can't we gotta have another chance to try it and figure it out? 6330 gave them that other chance. Volcker, the Volcker decision from this court, said that a taxpayer should go to tax court and can challenge the notices of deficiency because that's what the IRS allowed. This case and 6330 should not be designed around what the IRS can do. 6330 ought to be that the taxpayer has a right under federal district court to challenge whether or not the process has been properly met, to challenge whether or not the underlying tax liability is valid, to determine whether or not all applicable rules and regulations have been followed. That's what 6330 was designed to do, is give that taxpayer that one last chance to try to figure it out. If that had occurred at the beginning of the process, lots of headaches and lots of litigation would have been avoided, but that didn't happen that way. So now we're to the point where Judge Scott has ruled that 6330 does not give the district court any jurisdiction because it dealt with income taxes in some way, shape, or form. But the question really is, would the federal district court have any jurisdiction then under any scenario that involves a taxpayer and his spouse and whether or not on collection due process they have done everything correctly? What tax would apply if you can't challenge underlying tax liability because at this point in time, because you didn't do it at the notice deficiency stage? Notice the deficiency stage, no challenge was made. The Patridges are entitled to the challenge at this point in time. And so that's why We filed the lawsuit originally in the federal district court. At the conclusion of Judge Scott's decision, we then had to proceed over in tax court as well as coming up here. And now tax court's coming up here as well. And it demonstrates what the problems are with 6330 and how the IRS has taken the position first that in the Volcker decision that you go to tax court and you can challenge the underlying tax liability. Now saying that there are arguments to the Seventh Circuit with respect to that, that Volcker was supposed to go to tax court and not go to district court, that those positions, that part was correct, but as to the issue of whether or not you could challenge the underlying tax liability, you can never do it at all. That's not, 6330 is not written that narrowly. 6330 was designed to include additional points. And as you take a look now at how Congress has now amended 6330, dealing with the issue of whether or not district court has jurisdiction, it demonstrates that district court had jurisdiction before this point and that the patronages fit the category of people who are entitled to that jurisdiction and to have those issues determined. Federal district courts, where you make the determinations as to what the applicability of the law and how it applies to the individuals. Tax court is limited jurisdiction and will not do that. District courts where that was supposed to be at. The petition to district court structured it that way. Judge Scott's decision in saying there was no subject matter jurisdiction was therefore incorrect. Unless there's any questions.
Ms. Bowman.
May it please the court. I'm Patricia Bowman, appearing on behalf of the government. 6330D provides that generally the tax court has jurisdiction in CDP proceedings. It's not exclusive because it goes on to say in those instances where the tax court will not otherwise have jurisdiction over the underlying tax liabilities, then jurisdiction is in the district court. But it's a limited exception for district court jurisdiction that Congress has now for the future eliminated, and in the future CDP proceedings will be reviewed solely in the tax court, regardless of whether or not the tax court has jurisdiction under the underlying taxes. But in this case, it's clear that the taxes are income taxes, and income taxes are within the jurisdiction of the tax court. So under 6330D, the tax court had exclusive jurisdiction over the CDP determination in this case, and they had to file their dispute with the CDP determination in the tax court and not the district court, and the district court properly dismissed the case. And as to Volcker, there's a line in the statement of facts indicating that the notice of determination had indicated that the taxpayers should proceed with the tax court in disputing their CDP determination. And for whatever reason, it's represented as saying, you know, they can raise the underlying tax liabilities in the tax court. But the law is clear that, and it is purely dicta. It was not at all relevant to this court's holding in Volcker, which was that you had to file it in the tax court if it was an income tax liability. But it is clear, and this court's recently ruled, that if you've gotten a notice of deficiency, you can't dispute the underlying tax liabilities in the context of a CDP proceeding. I mean, it's just limited what CDP is about. It's about whether or not you received all the proper notices so that collection can proceed. And in this case, in the tax court proceeding, which is not yet before this court, but in the tax court proceeding, the tax court rules that they did receive the proper notices, that they got notice of deficiency, they got notice of assessment and demand for payment, and all the relevant notices to entitle the IRS to continue with collection. And CDP proceedings, I mean, doesn't eliminate the fact that Congress has also provided a refund remedy. So if there's no other questions, thank you.
Anything further?
Just briefly, the suggestion that the notice of deficiency and the taxes involved are proper always is one that's clearly in dispute in this instance, because the whipsaw process and the notices of deficiency that are part of this case, the whipsaw process is one that is not followed by the IRS in any other instance that I've ever seen. It's not one where the IRS is playing two people off the middle. The IRS, in fact, resulted in the Patridges having an income tax bracket of 70% of their income before penalties and interest. Ultimately, the entirety of it was their entirety of their income for the 96 to 97 years were based on taxes and penalties and interest within just a few dollars. It's clear the notices of deficiency weren't valid. The question really is whether or not they ought to have an opportunity to resolve that when the people that they hired to deal with this did nothing, whether they are, in effect, prohibited from ever touching this again because somebody else did something or failed to do something that they were supposed to do. We believe that they're entitled to have that right.
Okay. Well, just, you know, I'll ask you a question. Normally in these cases where somebody's also criminally prosecuted, as the husband was here,
yes,
and gets convicted,
yes,
and gets a fairly lengthy prison sentence.
5 years.
5 years. There is accompanying orders by the district judge to make good on your tax obligations.
Tax loss and restitution.
Were those orders entered in the criminal case?
Tax loss was based on the assessments. The restitution was the correct tax amount, including penalties and interest, which was half of the amount from the notices of deficiency, about $124,000.
Thanks.
Sure.
All right, we'll take this case under advisement.